The following program was transcribed earlier for presentation at this time.
Welcome to The Author Meets the Critics, where today's guests are Pearl Buck and Islanda Good Robeson, collaborators on a new book called American Argument. In a moment, Mrs. Buck and Mrs. Robeson will come to grips with their critics in a literary free-for-all. But first, meet the umpire on these programs, whose task today, heaven help him, is to keep the peace between four women, your regular chairman, John K.M. McCaffrey.
Good afternoon, everyone. Pearl Buck, known all over the world for her novels of Chinese life, needs no introduction. Her new book, American Argument, is what she calls a talk book. She's written talk books before, one about Russia with a Russian woman, another about the German people with a German woman. American Argument is the report of a long conversation with a fellow American, Mrs. Paul Robeson. Now, I'm going to ask each of the participants in this talk book to tell you what their talk is about. And first, the author of The Good Earth and famous friend of China, Pearl Buck.
Well, as you know, I've lived most of my life away from America, my own country. And so when I came back, there was a great deal here which I didn't understand and which I couldn't live through because there wasn't time. So I thought I'd like to do a book about a country I didn't know well enough, which happened this time to be my own. And I chose an American whom I thought had experienced more of it and perhaps more successfully than perhaps any other American I could have chosen. I chose Islanda Robeson.
Well, now I would like to ask for the other side of the American argument, the wife of Paul Robeson and author herself, Islanda Good Robeson, to talk about American argument from her point of view.
Well, I have, as an American citizen, been thinking very long and deeply about the so-called American way of life, and I was very grateful for a chance to discuss it, to talk about it, and to think it through with someone else who was troubled about it and who could see it more or less in focus as I could, because Pearl spent a great deal of her life in China, then came back to America to live. I spent a great deal of my life in America and went abroad to live for 12 years. So having lived it and gone abroad, I got it in focus in one way, and she, having heard about it all her life and then come home to live, got it in focus in another way. Both of us have had a great deal of experience with other ways of life, other values, other systems of living, and so I think we were in a position to examine ours affectionately and critically and in a family sort of way as members of our own family, this American system.
Well, now you have heard two comments on the American argument from the authors of the American argument. And now let's give our critics a chance to join the argument with one of their own. First, the well-known book reviewer, Virgilia Peterson.
I'm sorry to say I find this kind of argument embarrassing. Both arguers are supremely convinced of their own and each other's superiority over the common run of women, and men too, I might add. So do I. They make a whole lot of tall, fancy statements that Americans don't do much about their children, that we Americans want to go to war and love war and out of apathy, at least, are letting ourselves be drawn into war continually, that American men don't know how to love, that American women...
I resent
women,
that, too.
So do I. That American women really like to be what Pearl Buck calls stalled cows. And that, according to Mrs. Robeson, all the Russians want is to live and let live. Now, those are a number of points which I fail to agree with. I think perhaps women's scope in this country, after all, is pretty well illustrated by the fact that this book is being taken seriously. And I would like to suggest to Mrs. Robeson that a book like this would scarcely ever see the light of day in Russia. They say Americans talk too much and do too little. They said that in their book. I think this is a sample, perhaps, of talking too much.
And now, one of the best-known and most loved figures in radio, whose own program is a mecca for all authors, Mary Margaret McBride.
Well, there's one thing certain. I'll never be able to keep up with Virgilia Peterson today, but I would like to quote from American Argument for part of the reason why I hope that it'll be read by thousands and thousands of American men and women and taken seriously. First, Islanda Robeson says, I want in America just what our Constitution and our Bill of Rights guarantee us. Pearl Buck says, there's nothing in America to which I do not feel I have the right if I want it and will work for it. And then Pearl Buck says again, closing her book, as Landa said about, what as Landa said about me applies to all Americans. She asked me if I were willing to give away a little of my precious individualism, if thereby all people could have more freedom to be themselves. And she asked me if I were willing to give up some of my privilege so that others could have more privilege. And she asked me if I were willing to give up some of my present security in order to make the world more secure for everybody. Well, Aslanda, says Pearl, the answer is yes. I am willing and I am ready. What do you make of that, Jill?
All right, Virgilia.
I don't want to be the most ill-mannered person in this group of majestically sweet and generous and tolerant people. I would like, therefore, to say before I continue that in a book of so many generalizations, obviously there are a large number of generalizations with which I would be forced to agree. And, of course, on Mrs. Robeson's side, in the question of our treatment of minorities in this country, no intelligent and decent-thinking person in this whole country or anywhere else in the world could help but agree with Mrs. Robeson and feel exactly what both authors feel about our attitude toward minorities. But there is, for instance, Mrs. Buck's feminism. Throughout the entire book, there is a question of woman being handicapped by being a woman. Woman is submerged in America. Poor woman. Here are two women, she says, who have risen successfully, who have managed to overcome the terrible handicap of their sex and who therefore have achieved maturity and wisdom. And she intimates, if only everyone else could achieve what they had achieved, this country would be perfectly run. I cannot agree that woman is submerged in this country. I'm afraid I feel that a little submersion might be frightfully healthy before we become a complete matriarchy.
Well, now, just before I go down for the third time, Miss Peterson...
Hold on, I'll give you a straw.
Miss McBride, what do you feel about the submerged woman? Certainly no one has been submerging you recently as far as your...
No one wants to submerge Mary
No,
Margaret.
But before I consider that, I'd just like to mention to Virgilia Peterson that while no right-thinking person, as she calls them, seem to feel any other way than the book feels about minorities, there must be millions of non-right-thinking people in our country. Don't you think it's important to take the subject up, Jill?
Oh, indeed I do, and there obviously are a great many people who think wrong. But again, Mrs. Robeson indicates that by our education, we learn from the word go, and even in our schools and from our teachers, intolerance.
Well, don't you think that's true
no,
in a
I
great
don't.
Many cases?
No, I don't. I've been to a great many schools, and I have children who have been to a good many schools, and I have never in my life been anywhere near a teacher or an adult with any influence on anyone I knew who had that point of view.
Well, that sounds like a generalization to me.
Well, I have to answer a generalization with a generalization.
In your history, in your reading of, say, the Civil War, the war between the states, you mean to say there was never
anything... Well, obviously
anything...
back there, and obviously now
well,
it goes on.
Part, isn't
but it?
It
isn't taught now, Mary Margaret.
What isn't?
It
history?
Isn't taught, history is taught, but it isn't taught to feel scorn and contempt for minorities. That rises up from word of mouth, from ignorant sources, and it is an influence upon children from other children who get it from their homes. But I don't believe that it's a principle in this country to teach the superiority of the white person or of the Anglo-Saxon Protestant. I don't believe it. It's not a principle. It's a horrible accident against which perhaps the schools don't do enough.
Mary Margaret?
Well, she probably went to school later than I did.
Mary Margaret, only about 2 years, perhaps.
Well,
but perhaps not for as long.
It's for the submerged woman, John McCaffrey, in whom you're interested.
No, I have no particular interest in her. I don't want to dive after my women, Mary Margaret.
Well, I think the only point that Pearl Buck and Mrs. Robeson make is that that too often our women think that you can't carry two things at one time, that you couldn't be a good wife and mother and still have a great many interests outside the home. I think these women who've managed to do it feel that it ought to be done by more women. And well, I think so, too.
Well, I think now that it's time, perhaps, to have some of these arguments which Miss Peterson has brought up answered by the authors themselves. We've heard Mary Margaret give her opinions on it. Now I'd like to hear Pearl Buck and Islanda Robeson give their opinions on Miss Peterson's opinions.
The prejudice is very close to me. I understand exactly what Miss Peterson means when she says that that prejudice is not taught in the schools, but I think perhaps if I explained to her what I meant, she might agree with me that it is a fact that prejudice is not inherent, it's not innate, it's not inherited, it doesn't exist when a child is born, and yet the children grow up we're accumulating a great deal of prejudice. Now, this comes from teaching. Whether it's by the community, by the behavior of their elders, in the home or in the schools, I don't know. But definitely, that is part of education. And so, a prejudice is educated into the child, and he gets it. It happens. And this I regret. This, I think, is a very serious thing in this country. It's one of the very important divisions within our ranks, and I think it's a great weakness.
Well, Mrs. Robeson, as the immoderator on this show, may I come in here and say that I found your point of view on this very question somewhat old-fashioned, in that I feel that the time is perhaps past when the kind of muckraking approach which you are taking toward prejudice is particularly constructive, because although we realize that there is a shame of prejudice in our country, it has become almost a cliché with liberals to say, oh, the South, oh, lynchings, and to condemn it and wrap it up into that little package, which I believe that you are doing. And it seems to me that there is a much more important thing to do as far as prejudice is concerned, and that is to cooperate with the very real forces, and particularly in the South, in our own country, which are cooperating to get rid of prejudice. We have found, in southern states, for instance, Negroes voting in primaries and in national elections for the first time. We have papers like the Journal in Atlanta, once again cooperating and saying, yes, we must give these people their rights as full first-class citizens. It seems to me merely to be an Ida M. Tarbell, as far as prejudice is concerned now, is a little old hat. It seems to me that to wrap it up into these old clichés of what has happened, without saying what we must do is cooperate with the people who want to change it, as I say, is a little old-fashioned.
Well, Mrs. Robeson does say that there are people in the South who don't feel that way anymore, but she claims that they're afraid to speak.
Oh, but they're not afraid to speak, because all we have to do is read the papers in the South today to find that there is a rising tide. We can find the people who are opposing the president's civil rights program, certainly, but there are people in the South who are supporting it. And all you have to do is look at the vote of the southern states in the last election, where a president ran on a clear-cut civil rights program, and the Dixiecrats didn't carry very many states.
I quite agree, and I think the only difference between us is that you are not on the receiving end. It's all very well to talk about being old-fashioned and being very modern and very generous about giving credit where credit's due. This I agree with, and this I do. But it's still important to me that I can go down south and be lynched tomorrow if I'm black and don't say, yes, sir, in the right place. This, I think, is a very serious thing. And I think the only difference, as I say, is I am it in this game of tag, and you are not, so you can afford to be very modern and very generous.
But I think perhaps both of us could afford to try to do something about it, which is the important thing.
That's right. So we wrote a book.
Yeah, Mrs. Buck. Pearl Buck.
Well, you know me, and you know I have no place on this program whatever, because I hate argument and fighting. And that's why the only reason I consented to be here is because Eslander is very good at argument, and I'm not. But I suppose I might go back. I like to have my say, you understand, but I've been brought up to be equally interested in the points of view of those who differ, and that doesn't make a good fighting program, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, we'll take care of that.
I think we haven't taken care of it enough because we've taken up the point that Mrs. Robeson stands for most of all, and unfortunately for the argument, all of us are more or less agreed on Mrs. Robeson's point, but Mrs. Buck makes some statements which to me belong in the department of wild remarks. She makes some very fancy generalizations about marriage and men's and women's relations. Now, she also makes statements about our interest in children. And she sums the whole thing up by the fact that we're not interested in human relations, and then she quaintly says we've installed public relations to take the place of human relations. Well, now,
Pearl Buck, what do you... What about this indictment?
I think she's interesting. That's too generous, Pearl Buck. Please don't be generous with me. I might have to turn on generosity, and I haven't any.
Take those things up one by one.
Well, I think she's probably right from how she looks at it. But about women, I don't think there's anything in our book which says that women are submerged in America.
The very word, Pearl Buck. I took the very word.
Yes.
Submerged out of the book. I love that word.
The word is there. But we didn't say that other people submerged women. We said women submerged themselves. That's different.
She said it was the fault of women. She was calling on women, trying. She said women could have anything they wanted in this country.
And as far as I can see,
they
do have it.
Oh, well, she didn't mean fur coats and stuff that you all are talking about.
No, no, I mean women's clubs and culture.
Well, we're not talking about women's clubs. We're talking about women as people. And considering that women are half the population of this country and half the population of the earth, they don't have enough participation in the government and in industry and the things that affect women, affect our lives, affect our children. I think anyone would admit that.
Mrs. Robson, have you been in the subway in the rush hour?
That doesn't manage our affairs from an international and a national point of view. That's an incident in life. But
do you know
think
the figures
that
how many women control the wealth of America, Mrs. Robson?
I beg your pardon?
The wealth of America is controlled primarily by women. It's in their hands.
Well, I don't think they're controlling it very well.
They may not be doing very well, but they've got it, and they've got the power. Now, you claim that they don't have enough influence in
our affairs. Well, I think they have it, as Pearl says, but they don't manage it. I think the men do the managing.
Well, if I had $1 million, I'd turn it over to somebody else to manage it just so I got the income from it. That's the important thing.
Well, that's all right, too, except that if men allowed women to be in the management business, for instance, to be in government and so on, perhaps we might get along a little better.
We had a Secretary of Labor, I believe, Frances Perkins, wasn't it?
I think she was a good one.
Ah, that's an interesting point of view.
Yes.
Well, I think that's a fair enough point of view. I've got to go along with Mrs. Robson on that. There's a thing that Phil Buck says that I agree with, but the philosophical background seems to me to be odd. She talks about too much competition in this country and that we are too competitive. I agree with that. I think nowhere in the world is the strain of competition for survival so bitter as it is in the United States. But then Pearl Buck assumes something, and later on that applies to their discussion of freedom and their discussion of communism. She assumes that we're all equal. I think we're all equal, quite obviously, in the eyes of the Lord, and we all ought to have equal opportunity. But who is to say that men and women are born equal? Are we born equal when there's a Shakespeare in one place and someone in an institution who has not been able to learn to read and write in another through no fault of either of them? There isn't any equality in humanity, and all you can give them is a chance to do what they can with what they've got. And when she goes on into the discussion of Russia, and into the discussion where Mrs. Robson says that all Russia wants is time and peace to have socialism in one state and live and let live, and we should live and let live too and let poor Russia alone. When do you read the papers, Mrs. Robson? What about the countries behind the Iron Curtain? Are they being allowed to live and let live?
You know everything about the things behind the so-called Iron Curtain. If all that news comes out and all of it bad, I don't think the curtain is so iron. But as far as, let's go back, I would like very much to go back to the children, because both Pearl and I have children, and we're terribly interested in that
subject. I've got a couple, too, in spite of being Miss Peterson. And I
bet
Miss McBride...
I don't know how I managed it.
That's fine. So perhaps
I don't know how
will...
I managed it being a man, but I have children, too.
Good for you. Good for you. Well, I would like to go back to that business of children, because I think it's important. Children are the future, of course. And I think that we haven't done a particularly good job on our children in this country. I say this because in a country which is enormously wealthy, enormously powerful, enormously industrially effective, we have perhaps the highest delinquency rate in the world. I think that is really a challenge to the way we handle our children.
I agree that the delinquency rate is a shock and a scandal, but I maintain in the same way that we have often been said to have more neurotically disturbed men in our army than any other armies, that other countries do not keep statistics of their juvenile delinquents, of their mentally deficient and mentally disturbed people drafted into their armies. And we have a very large population, and we take a great deal of trouble with statistics, and we advertise these numbers. I wouldn't dare to make the generalization that we have more than anywhere else in the world.
Well, our authorities on these things say this, and I take their word for it. I'm a scientist, and I have to rely on
them. Would you say seriously, Mrs. Robeson, that you believe that there are more delinquent children in the United States than in the bombed cities of Germany, in a Europe which has been torn and ravaged by war, where there are hundreds of thousands of homeless children wandering just loose, and you would say that there were more delinquents here in America because we define delinquency within the forms of a fairly peaceful civilization?
No,
that seems to be the most superficial kind of generalization.
But, Mr. McCaffrey, just a minute. I didn't say that at all. When you come to the effects of a war, that's another story. We have to rearrange our statistics. But I can take up to the war before there was bombing. And I can say this. At least so our authorities say. I didn't go out there and count them. But on our prison records, our statistics on these matters, you have only to consult the facts. You'll find it.
Would you say, Mrs. Robeson, that there were more people in prisons in the United States than there are in Russia, including the slave labor camps and the political prisoners?
This I don't know. If you want to get me on that ground, you have to get a little more solid ground, and then
well,
you will...
Well, David Dolan's book on the Soviet labor camps you probably are familiar with, and that gives
well,
you a good deal
of... Well, let's discuss our book. Let's discuss right.
I want to get you on the ground of one thing for a woman for whom I have such deep respect as I really have for you, and I know that you are an honest and sincere and fine and intelligent woman. How can you sit up there and say that liquidation of the people who disagree in a country is the a means of achieving the right end in government? How can you defend Russia's principle of getting rid of, by any means, however foul, the people who set themselves against the government? And then you collaborate on a book in which you criticize our government and our methods and our foreign policy, and you are glad that we are free here to be able to do that, and at the same time you are defending a system where such a thing would be impossible and where you yourself would not only be in Siberia but probably in limbo by this time.
Well, I have been in Russia, and let's get through with this right away, because, you know, I'm very tired of listening to programs about something else and ending up on Russia. I think much too much of this is done, and it's nonsense. So let's get on with this and get through with it. I do approve of liquidation up to this point, and I wish you would understand this. I think that a man like Franco should have been liquidated. I would approve of that. I think a man like Hitler should have been liquidated. I approve of that. If there is no other way to stop him, to stop the terrific destruction that such a person will let loose.
But the principle of liquidation leaves it to the judgment of anyone to decide who should be liquidated. Supposing you had a Hitler at the head of this government who wanted to liquidate a Roosevelt and who had swayed everybody to believe that Roosevelt was a danger.
Well, I'll say just one more thing about this liquidation. When you consider, of course, all of this comes from a background of your being free, white, and 21, and me being black, figuratively speaking, and a member of a minority. And I come from a race where 150 million people were liquidated in the slave trade. That, too, was liquidation, you know, only another kind. So I have a different approach to liquidation, and with that, I'll just leave it there and take it over to Pearl.
Well, can I say just one thing here? I suppose that this was the thing upon which, as Landa and I disagreed most violently, wasn't it?
Yes,
Landa?
It was.
We had a real argument on this.
It was awful
but
polite,
I suppose, though. Well, perhaps we are
she's polite.
She's a polite people.
Woman, which I think
I
is
admire.
No discredit to her.
Well, I can't help it. I was brought up in China.
Which is a serious commentary on American life and manners.
Well, I like America very much. But what I really started to say was that Esland and I did disagree on this business of liquidation. But I suppose now that I've been thinking about it since, that, and also got them letters from Japan, quite a lot of Japanese people, who spoke of our liquidating their war criminals. Now, I can quite see, I understand why we did that, but they used that word, too. And I suppose people in Germany would say that we liquidated some people, too. And I think maybe Aslanda has something when she says that it really depends on which side you're standing on or just what this liquidation is. All the same, Aslanda, I didn't agree with you. You remember that, don't you?
I remember that distinctly. And I do remember that we discussed the Franco business and all the people who were liquidated in Spain, but nobody mentions them at all. There's been a lot of liquidation, but curiously enough, when you come to the Russian thing, everybody becomes wild and frightened and hysterical, and so it doesn't alarm me at all.
Anyway, we don't know anything about it.
Well, I lived right in the middle of it until Hitler kicked me out, and I saw the liquidation going on, and I'm not accusing just Russia. I disagree with all liquidation of all people just because other people fear them. I think we simply have to triumph in some other way.
I think so, too, and I hope so, but until we do, something will have to be done about it, and I'm for the lesser liquidation.
There's one thing I would like to say simply so as not to be the sourest woman in this majestic group, and that is that you have a statement somewhere that your son told you once, you do your homework. I love that, and I would like to say that I think, after all, in spite of some of the windy generalizations, both of you have done your homework.
Well, thank you very much. That's truly a compliment.
Well, now, Miss Buck, in having this American argument with Aslanda Good-Robeson, was the only place where you had a hot argument on the subject of liquidation as you were writing this book?
I should say that was the place where we disagreed most absolutely, because I don't believe in killing anybody. That's perhaps extreme from an American point of view. But I think you can lock people up or you can segregate them into jails. Don't like to use that word, segregate, but I mean put them in jails if they're bad. But I don't believe in killing, you see, because I think when you kill somebody in war or in peace, and I call war killing just the same, you do something to yourself. And that's what's terrible about killing. It isn't the person that's killed that has the bad effects. He just quits, that's all. But it's the person that does it that suffers.
I think that that's very true. And I think one of the important things about American argument, and even the kind of argument we've been having here, is that in America and under a democracy, any kind of a democracy, whether it flourishes here or elsewhere, that what we are primarily concerned with is the principles which govern our conduct. It is not whether or not we put someone in jail, whether we repress or inhibit certain kinds of actions. The important thing to us as Americans and as Democrats is that we find a modus operandi, a way to work, a way to do it with equality and fairness and justice to all men. It is not the act itself, because we know from children need discipline, children need to be controlled and sustained at times, and it's only that we do it with the interest of the child, as well as we must also do it in the best interest of the individual, according to a set of principles which are workable. And I'm sorry now that time's up for both our authors and their critics, and here is your announcer to tell you what lies ahead on the program.
Next week, our guest author will be Robert St. John, the famous foreign correspondent and author. His new book, Shalom Means Peace, is a report on the new nation of Israel. Be sure to be with us next Sunday when Mr. St. John meets his critics face to face. And now back to John McCaffrey.
Before closing, I'd like to thank Pearl Buck and Mrs. Robeson for coming here today to discuss their new book, American Argument. And to thank you, Miss McBride and Miss Peterson, for joining us. This is John McCaffrey saying good afternoon for The Author Meets the Critics.
Meets the Critics, produced by Martin Stone and directed by Lee Jones. This is Merrill Brandt speaking.
For several weeks, The Author Meets the Critics has been campaigning for new books for disabled veterans. Today, we'd like to speak of a very special group of these men in Northport Hospital, the group of the emotionally disturbed. Perhaps even more than physically handicapped men, the emotionally ill need the help that comes from new ideas and books. But what kind of books should they be? This is the real challenge to the librarian of Northport Hospital. Taste varies among these veterans as much as it varies everywhere. Some men have vocational interests carried over from before the war. A farmer or a mechanic will find not only distraction, but a real boost to morale and health in technical books on the jobs which they plan to take up again. Others have old hobbies, motorboats, stamp collecting, photography, and books on these subjects help to restore their joy in life. But almost all the veterans of World War II like to keep up with current fiction. If you've just found a new book which roused your own interest, why not send it to the veterans at Northport Hospital, Northport, Long Island, New York. Thank you. The preceding program was transcribed and came to you from our WNBC studios in Radio City, New York.